Hi there, I'm Janet Canters, managing editor of SpudSmart magazine and SpudSmart.com. This SpudSmart podcast is brought to you by McCain Foods and features Craig Hunter, research and crop protection specialist with the Ontario Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association. In late November, the PMRA released a proposal to phase out imidacloprid, a neonicotinoid insecticide used by commercial applicators and growers to manage insects on a large number of agricultural crops, including potatoes, in which it provides extended control of Colorado potato beetle, aphids, potato leafhopper, and potato flea beetle. We spoke with Craig to determine what this phase-out might mean for potato growers. So how long has imidacloprid been registered for use in Canada?
Imidacloprid was first registered for use on Colorado potato beetle in 1995. The Ontario and Quebec growers in particular at that time had lost the use of every other registered insecticide to control Colorado potato beetle due to resistance. And it was a desperate situation, and the registration was approved at that time.
Was it classified as an emergency registration then, or was it a new product that had gone through the proper registration channels?
It was a new insecticide and the first in the class of neonicotinoids. Mm-hmm. It was known to be effective and was registered already in the USA. Because of the severe problem in Canada, the registration was put through the system, and it was approved for use for the Canadian growers at that time.
So it's been approved since then all across Canada?
That's correct. And a number of other crops have been added over time. One of them is recently is this past fall, it got a registration to control an exotic or invasive pest called the brown marmorated stink bug, which can affect a great number of crops.
What pests in potatoes does imidacloprid control specifically?
The first and foremost, the most important, is the Colorado potato beetle. The second would be aphids. The third would be flea beetles. The fourth would be leafhoppers. And the fifth would be the whole family of shaper, European shaper in particular, even Japanese beetle and white grubs. It will control all of those.
It's obvious imidacloprid is important to the potato growing sector in Canada to control the pests. So, Craig, if the insecticide is eventually phased out, how will that affect potato growers?
Well, one of the beauties of this particular application is the multiplicity of pests that it does control with one application. If the product is no longer available for use on potatoes, then I expect one, two, three, even four other insecticides might be needed, and maybe even multiple applications of other insecticides would be needed through the season to do the same job that this one does. You would have to have products that would control all these various pests. If I go back to 1980, when this didn't exist, we might have been using three or four different insecticides to do the job. This one by itself is doing the job on all of these species. Most new modern pesticides that have come out in the last 20 years tend to be very specific to one or two insects or one family of insects. And so to cover this spectrum of pests, you're going to need several of these newer products to do the same job.
Right.
And then because they're more specific in the way they work, they become more prone to resistance. And so you can't rely on using just one of those things. You need to have an arsenal of two or three of these for each of the pest families so you can rotate to put off resistance developing in your crop and in your field. We've opened up a Pandora's box, is kind of what I'm saying.
I've read that in the last 15 years, imidacloprid is the most widely used insecticide in the world.
Correct. Spectrum of activity and the number of crops that it can be used on exceeded any other pesticide. It came along at the same time that organophosphate and carbamate insecticides were being taken out of the marketplace and in many cases replaced the use of these older products to control the pests that we have. In turn, the carbamates and the OPs replaced the organochlorine products that had come before them. I don't see another big family of new insecticides coming along that's going to do the same job. It's going to take several of these newer ones because they are so specific.
That was my next question, is are you aware of any research or pending products that might be able to almost take its place?
Well, there's products that are registered that might control aphids, and there's products out there that might control flea beetles, and there are products that will control some of the strains of Colorado potato beetle, and there are products that will control chafers and grubs, but we're talking about a whole series of products. And at the end of the day, we're going to be faced with either using this product judiciously according to the label and making sure that no adverse effects occur, or replacing it with a myriad of other products, all of which have to be used safely and according to the label and hopefully with no adverse effects. But if you do whole cost accounting on that, I wonder what we're gaining. The other perhaps more serious question that is arising is the regulatory uncertainty. Here's a product that was approved for use. There has been not a single case documented on the PMRA's website of adverse effects in the field to any of these insects. And yet, nonetheless, they're proposing to eliminate the use. And so if you have a new insecticide that you've developed in another country, and it's registered perhaps in 10 or 20 or 30 countries around the world, would you spend your money to try and develop it for the Canadian marketplace if you're really facing regulatory double jeopardy every day after that? What's the point? Companies will not invest their money in nebulous marketplaces. They will invest their money where they have more regulatory certainty and the more likelihood that the product will be continued to be available in the absence of hard data that shows there's a problem. There is no hard data anywhere that anyone has shown that this is causing actual harm. What we've got is potential harm or suspected potential harm. Like, that's a big difference.
Is Canada the only country that is proposing this phase out of imidacloprid?
Of course, we know that Europe has suspended the use of all the neonicotinoids, including this one, because of suspicion of the effect it has on bees. And that was done 4 years ago now. Interestingly, the problem with the bees continued unabated even without this being used. And in the UK, for instance, they have had serious pest control problems and have used multiple applications of foliar insecticide instead of this as a seed treatment, and still has crop loss. And so, notwithstanding the decision to suspend the use of the product, the bee situation in Europe hasn't changed. nor has it changed in Ontario. In fact, it's changed the other way. The bee survival rate over the last winter was the best it's been in many a year, even before the Ontario embargo on the use of it for seed treatments on corn and soybeans has taken into effect.
Can you tell me a little bit about the special review the PMRA is conducting on clothianidin and thiamethoxam?
It's a special review which they are doing on the basis of monitoring, environmental monitoring data that implicated that they were finding levels of these other products as well. All of these products are already under review for the pollinator issue anyway.
Right.
And so it's interesting that notwithstanding all the work they've done with it on with pollinators themselves, this other set of reviews has happened sort of behind a closed door and not really known to anybody that it was taking place.
So if clothianidin and thiamethoxam are also phased out over time, what will that mean for the industry?
When these products were first registered, they came at a time that coincided with the loss of the use of almost all our old carbamate and organophosphate products. And we're talking about things like glutathione and parathione and products like that. They were all lost because of reevaluation, data requirements, and so on and so on. But because these were available, they very successfully filled in and covered the looming loss of insect control. And so they fit right in, and they've been used successfully for a wide number of crops across Canada and around the world. We don't have this big arsenal of new products sitting in the wings to take over from these if we lose them. And I wish we did. I wish it was that kind of development. But if one looks back on history, when glyphosate first really took off and started to replace many, many herbicides, companies that owned all these other herbicides that were used broadly on millions upon millions of acres around the world, they lost sales of those herbicides. And so rather than put money back into new herbicide research, they spent a lot of money instead looking at new insecticides and fungicides. And so since about 2000, we have been getting a huge number of new fungicides and insecticides registered because companies weren't going to risk their money in the herbicide market if glyphosate had the whole marketplace. Well, the fruits of those developments have come and gone, and with the concern about glyphosate resistance, the herbicide development teams are back in action, and the insecticide and fungicide people aren't as busy or are not doing as much as they were. Couple that with that is the merger and amalgamations of major companies, and the products of their research and development. If you add 1 plus 1, it makes 1.2, not 2, because of the way that they're going to make more money is to consolidate. And so the research departments that are producing brand new active ingredients are not what they were. Bottom line, we're not going to see a whole lot of new insecticides in the next 10 to 20 years. We've got what we've got. And what we've got, there is no single silver bullet. We're going to need a combination of several products to do the whole job that this one will do. I'm worried about resistance because of the loss of this product. We've been using Canada now for 22 years, and so far we haven't had resistance problems. They have had some in the U.S., I grant you that. But growers have been very responsible in how they've used these products here, so we don't have that problem yet. But we will have it if we start to rely on single-site types of materials, or if we don't have enough new families of active ingredients with different modes of action that we can use successively or as tank mixes to prevent resistance from being put into place. But if companies don't have confidence in our regulatory environment, none of that will matter, because if they stop sending new active ingredients to Canada to get registered because they don't have confidence that they'll last long enough to make them a profit, then we're really in trouble. Really, really in trouble. We'll go back to where we were 30 years ago when Canada was shunned as a place to send products. And I don't want to see that happen.
The PMRA has opened this decision to public consultation until February 21st of this year. Do you think, Craig, that there will be a lot of feedback from the industry?
Oh, of course. Companies will absolutely be sending in comments, as will many grower groups. Unfortunately, growers can document how important these products are to them. I think PMRA already knows that. I think that we can talk about the uses that we have and what potential alternatives there might be from what's already registered. But again, none of those alternatives would be as welcomed as the continued use of this product. The area that needs the comment, though, you have to focus comments on what is the issue at hand. What is it that's driving PMRA to make the proposal? And the issue at hand is that they have taken laboratory experimental data to determine toxicity in a pristine laboratory environment, and then compared that number with field monitoring data, and some of the data shows that the levels were approaching levels of concern. However, there is other data that was done in the field that would suggest that the toxicity numbers calculated in the laboratory experiments are 10 to 100 fold less sensitive in the real environment than what the laboratory numbers would say, which would mean that none of the data from field observations would indicate that you have an imminent threat of toxicity. And there is absolutely no data from the field to show biota monitoring, like monitoring of the bugs themselves, to see if, in fact, there has been any negative effect taking place. And so somewhere along the line, there has to be a very frank and open discussion between the scientists who've done work in the lab and the scientists who've done work in the field to come back with a more realistic toxicity number. Now, having said all that, these products are insecticides. They kill insects. Every one of them says so on the label, and every one of them says that these are toxic to beneficial insects if they get out into the environment. Fair enough. And if they are finding it in the environment where it shouldn't be, we need to focus in on where that came from and what can we do to reduce. One should always try to reduce any emissions they possibly can, but there are consequences to everything that we do, and they take that into effect in the registration process. So I don't want to see these residues at levels that maybe some people think are of concern, but I sure as heck want to know where they came from and not have a very broad brush approach where all the uses are proposed to be canceled. If there are some uses that are causing or leading to these numbers, let's deal with those. Fair enough. But if the numbers that they've got don't line up with in the field real life toxicity values, have to eliminate the uses. There has to be a lot more monitoring done, a lot more focused monitoring, so we can narrow down where the problems are and then deal with them. It's like saying that a baseball went over a fence and broke the glass in somebody's window, and you suspend the entire set of school kids for doing it. You don't even know that a school kid threw the ball over the fence. It might have been a teacher, just as an example. So it doesn't seem right, the approach that's been taken, until there's a lot more information. And along the line of information, not everyone would know, but in the Pest Control Products Act, there is a mandatory adverse effects reporting requirement that any registrant who comes across or learns of any adverse effect caused by their active ingredient must, in short order, report that to the PMRA. Well, there hasn't been any reported, so there hasn't been any adverse effects reported or found. Why is it that the registrant is required to do that, and yet Environment Canada, who did a lot of the monitoring, is not required to report the results of their monitoring? That would have been a first heads up to everybody that, hey, they're finding this stuff out there. Let's start looking at where it came from. Let's have a chance to do something about it. To suddenly get broadsided by the proposal out of the dark, out of the blue, it's just a little over the top for me.
In your experience, when the PMRA suggests a phase out of a product in the past, which I believe they have before, what is the ultimate end game? Has those proposed phase outs, have they always occurred? Is this just an exercise in futility for the farmers? So will you and or the Ontario Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association be supplying a comment?
The Canadian Hort Council helps to coordinate all these activities on a national basis for horticulture, just like the Canola Council does for canola, Pulse Canada, and so on, Cereals Canada. So the comments will be coming in from Hort Council. We're talking about more than potatoes, of course. There's literally 100 or more crops that this is labeled on. So all of those crops have a stake in the outcome. The companies are the ones that are most privy to the scientific data and the toxicology data, without a doubt. Growers can comment directly to PMRA through their website. They can certainly contact their local MP and let them know how important the product is on their farm and what that means to their productivity. They can share their concerns about the effects of having to use multiple products instead of just one. And at the end of the day, we'll have to hope that good science is used to make the final decision.
Okay, thanks, Craig. Do you have any closing comments?
Well, this review is one of many that have happened, and the list is, as far as I know, 34 more of these during 2017. So growers will be asked to provide information for many of those 34 during the next 12 months. So I really hope we can get cooperation and get the backing of the growers as we try to fight to maintain uses that are critical for Canadian agriculture.
Okay. Thanks, Craig. I really appreciate the time you spent.
No problem, Janet. Glad to help.
Well, that's it for today. I'd like to thank our listeners and our podcast sponsor, McCain Foods, founded by farmers and proud to invest in Canadian farmers, families, and communities for 60 years. Make sure to visit spudsmart.com to subscribe to future podcasts. Bye for now.